Hi, this is Marketplace Money for the weekend of September 11th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. So, here's what happened a year ago.
Our entire economy is in danger.
I am convinced that this bold approach will cost American families far less than the alternative.
If you're not worried today, you're really not paying much attention.
Since I have no control over what the financial market is doing right now, I thought, well, I won't look.
And what the regulators are afraid is that the credit system will freeze up and all of a sudden pink slips start getting handed out.
I've never seen this in my lifetime, and it's got me worried.
Action by the Congress is urgently required to stabilize the situation and avert what otherwise could be very serious consequences for our financial markets and for our economy.
Yes, it's been 1 year since the economic meltdown. What have you learned? Well, we're saving more, we're paying off debts, but have we really changed? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
So here is an admission. The financial crisis of the last year scared me straight. Every day I watched headline after headline roll across about another huge bank on the edge of death, the Dow rising and falling by 800, 900 points a day. Our family did little things, like making coffee at home instead of stopping at Starbucks on the way to work, and big things, like putting together an emergency fund. Even for those of us lucky enough to keep our jobs, the fear was palpable. Intimate because it was our money at stake, yet utterly global in scale. By February, when stocks hit bottom, we wondered if it might take decades to recover. Less than 6 months after that, Newsweek's cover story blared, "The recession is over." And now maybe we can admit we're feeling better. So where does that leave our promises to change our ways? How quickly can we forget the lessons of the year since the collapse of Lehman Brothers? Can a leopard change its spots? First, some thoughts from the streets of New Orleans, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., and Portland. What, if anything, did you learn from this past year?
I don't think 1 year is going to make a difference. They'll go back to their old habits.
I think we'll probably be changed forever.
They've had to learn a lesson.
I don't think so. I mean, if a person goes to jail, they find this new belief in God and everything. But when they get out and they know good times are ahead, it's like, okay, who cares?
There won't be any lesson learned out of this mess because human nature is what it is.
And I think mostly as Americans, we have a tendency to learn our lesson. We look at history, we see what history brings us, and then we have a tendency to adjust. Not all of us.
We look at history and we adjust. Really? Aren't we kind of known for our short memories? Well, we put the leopard question to folks whose job it is to ponder such things. Author and personal finance columnist Liz Pulliam Weston starts us off.
People are changing their behaviors, and the obvious question is this going to last? I think for certain people it will. I think for those in their 20s who had never experienced a recession before, this was one great wake-up call. I do think a lot of people are learning lessons. They're seeing dramatically how important an emergency fund is. You know, emergency funds are sexy. Who would have thought that would ever happen? That is really cool. That said, I do think as soon as credit eases up, you will see folks, a lot of people, going back to some of their old habits. But maybe something will be in the back of their mind now that they shouldn't count on things going super well forever.
I'm Kurt Anderson. I'm the host of Studio 360 and the author of Reset, How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. For two centuries plus so far, that's what we, the American leopard, have done repeatedly, is we have one kind of spotting for a decade or more, and then we switch to a different approach to spending and getting and buying and all the rest, and we go back and forth. This last period has been an exceptionally long one of a certain kind of American paradigm, a quarter century. So one does wonder, has it been so long that we've forgotten what the old ways were like? But I'm hopeful.
I'm Felix Salmon. I'm the finance blogger for Reuters. I see this as a reversion to the mean. We overshot. We borrowed way too much. And we're back to the levels at which we were borrowing a few years ago. And those levels are entirely sustainable. They're still pretty high in the grand scheme of things. There's still quite a lot of consumer borrowing going on. It's just not ridiculously excessive. They're being a bit more sensible about things.
I'm Jane Bryant Quinn. I'm a financial writer and author. My current book is Smart and Simple Financial Strategies for Busy People. We do have short memories. I think it may even have been Benjamin Franklin who said, more or less, everybody lives to the highest standard of living that they can afford, because that's what you want to do. That's just human nature. That's how it works out. Do I think that if all of our troubles straightened out, people would want to be borrowing money and spending again? Yes, I do. The reason I think it won't happen is that I believe that we will be constrained simply because we're not going to have the money and the banks won't be lending as much, and it will be much more difficult to build yourself up on debt.
I'm Chris Farrell. I'm the economics editor for Marketplace Money. I am convinced that this is one of those traumatic periods in our history that does have a dramatic influence on the way we spend and the way we save. First of all, we haven't had wage increases in a long time, and we're not going to get wage increases, so that's one factor. Another factor is a great taboo was broken during the Great Recession that we just went through. Companies became comfortable after the early 1980s with mass layoffs. Well, now, furloughs, benefit cuts. So I think that's going to continue to weigh on people. And the final factor that I would say is, you know, everything went down at once. Home values went down. The stock market went down. I think that's going to haunt people for a long period of time.
My name is Nick Retsinas. I am the director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I think a leopard can change spots. I don't know if it can change species. I think for investors, no. People will still be looking for the deal, looking for the financing that makes sense, and are willing to be optimistic that they're really sort of downplaying or understating what the risk is. In terms of the larger population that buys and sells, yeah, I think the memories will be lasting. Will they be eternal? No. But I think for the next decade or so, it's pretty clear that people won't assume that they can make money owning a house, and that ought to be the primary motivation.
I'm Knight Kiplinger, editor-in-chief of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine and Kiplinger.com. You know, people turn very cautious when they are fearful, and that cautiousness is driving today's boom in savings. But remember, this new frugality has only pushed the savings rate up to about 5%. We have a long way to go to turn this frugal chic into a traditional habit of savings, which used to be the norm in America, that 10%, 12% savings rate, which we had a generation or two ago. But I think that we can log a fairly consistent 7 or 8%. I'm pretty positive, pretty optimistic that this is an achievable new norm in America.
An achievable new norm. Let's ask once again whether you agree.
I certainly think that people are a lot more aware. You won't see that happen again. People aren't going to rush to go into these things with that much risk.
What has it been, a year and a half, and it's getting better now? So, I mean, if it seems like it can almost be shrugged off.
I think spending foolishly is the American way.
I think this is a wake-up call to, in fact, crawl out of our illusion and get real.
I think that the country as a whole is more careful for a few minutes, and then they'll just go right back to their spending ways, because once someone is careful for too long, then they freak out and spend all their money right away.
Uh-oh, let's hope not. You know, lots of Americans were mad that they were bailing out people who didn't make wise financial decisions, from bank CEOs to homeowners. So when it comes to changing our spots, will we, should we, take more responsibility for our own financial literacy? Here again, Jane Bryant Quinn.
I think that there is all too much blaming the victim here, Tess. Obviously, we are responsible for ourselves. Presumably, we should have read through all 29 pages of the mortgage document and understood every word of it. But the fact is that people don't do that, and even if you read it through, you wouldn't understand. And even when you got to the table, they always changed the terms. And I think that a great deal of the blame needs to fall on the mortgage companies, on the bankers that made a lot of money on them and ran.
And what about those banks? Wall Street. My marketplace colleague Kai Rizdahl often scans the morning headlines. Toxic assets repackaged. Investor appetite for risk returns. And he pronounces,
what we have here is a crisis wasted.
Reuters' Felix Salmon tends to agree.
I don't think Wall Street's learned a lesson at all. The minute that Wall Street started being able to borrow money again, it jumped in with both feet, and it's been borrowing money all year this year, basically since March. It's just been borrowing more than you can possibly imagine, trillions of dollars in new corporate debt issuance. It seems that Wall Street has already forgotten the dangers of too much debt.
Then what is the danger that we as the average investor will forget as well and start investing in the things that they tell us to?
Well, that's a real risk because we don't have a lot of choice. As individuals, we can basically invest in stocks and bonds and bond funds, really, and that's about it. And if Wall Street is just taking those markets and making them riskier and riskier, then that's ultimately what we as individual investors are going to wind up investing in. So it's a risk for us on an individual level.
And finally, what about all those comparisons to the Great Depression? Certainly our parents and grandparents changed their spots after seeing the breadlines and panics of the stock market crash. But as for us, here again, Liz Pulliam-Weston.
I have always thought that this Great Depression talk was way overblown. I don't think anybody who studied the Great Depression would see more than superficial parallels to what we've got now. You know, we're talking about a recession that might even be over at this point, but I just can't see that it's going to have the huge and lasting impact that the Great Depression had on that greatest generation.
And we've got more coverage of the Lehman anniversary, including a timeline of key events in the financial crisis, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding, online at finrafoundation.org.
Coming up, a small town bank that didn't take bailout money. They make profits without the red tape. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Vermont is one of only two states in the nation that doesn't have a single bank that took bailout money. That's because the Green Mountain State has no large banks chartered within its borders. In fact, you can't even find a single branch of the big institutions like Citibank or Bank of America. It does, however, have one of the smallest banks in the country with just 5,000 customer accounts. From Vermont Public Radio, Jane Lindholm has this profile.
The First National Bank of Orwell is the only bank in Orwell, Vermont. Orwell is a farming community with about 1,000 people at the southern end of Lake Champlain. Dairy farms dot the countryside, and the bank sits in the small village, not far from the school and the general store. The bank is the kind of place where everybody knows your name.
Hi, how are you, Mr. Goddard?
Quite well, and you?
I am good today.
I can see that. If it's any better, you'd be too good, right?
Yeah, right.
It's been this way for almost 200 years. This is the oldest nationally chartered bank in New England, and it's still in its original brick building, the word bank spelled out roughly in marble letters above the entrance. Inside, warm light filters through antique green lamps. Some of the furniture has been in place for at least 100 years. The tellers use old wooden coin trays, and they talk to their customers through brass grates worn dull below original signs that just say teller. Like on this day, when a group of second graders crowded around.
Can we please have a check for $350?
And how are you going to pay for that check?
Right here. Right there. That's how much
there
is.
Okay, you know what I have to do? I have to count it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, this is it.
And who is the check going to be made to?
Malaria no more.
Okay. It's going to take me a minute, okay?
Okay.
One of these Orwell second graders had a grandmother working as a teller, and their teacher, Mrs. Young, who corralled the rambunctious class into the small lobby, is married to the bank's president. Her son, Brian Young, is the bank's vice president. The bank has been in the family since 1888, and Brian Young is the fifth generation to actually live in the bank. He and his siblings grew up in the attached house.
It's always been an extension of our home, so it wasn't unusual for us at all to come home from school and come into the bank and play around. They'd set us to counting a stack of cash, and I'm sure most of that was done just to keep us busy, but that was not unusual pastime for my siblings and I.
In fact, this bank might seem a bit unusual. Young says the bank doesn't offer credit cards, and its four loan officers don't make subprime loans.
Our size gives us a distinct advantage of being able to underwrite every loan. All of the loan officers sit down and discuss the merits of a loan, and we can truly make a decision on every loan individually, and there doesn't have to be any set of underwriting rules or any manual to follow. As cliche as it sounds, it's definitely not by the book. There is no book for us.
Young admits that the small size of the bank is a challenge. There are only two branches, and the bank can't compete with larger chains. Its ATM machine has a dial-up modem. Vermonters have to cross state lines or bank online if they want access to a big national bank like Bank of America or Citibank. Some do, but Young says his bank has an advantage.
I guess every part of Orwell is tied into the bank, and the bank's probably tied into so many others. The relationships between stores and churches and organizations and the bank are so intermingled that, they all mean a great deal to each other.
And a great deal to Orwell's balance sheet. Young says both loans and deposits have increased significantly over the past year. In Orwell, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace Money.
In his speech to Congress this week, President Barack Obama said he is not the first president to try to reform the nation's health care system, but he intends to be the last. Everyone in Washington says they want to contain the cost of health care. But all of the plans under discussion, from the public option to nonprofit co-ops to the status quo, have one thing in common. They all hide the real cost of health care from consumers. Joel Rose reports.
If you're like most Americans, you probably get health insurance through your employer, and you probably have no idea what that coverage actually costs. USC economist Darius Lakdawala says most people only know how much they have to pay out of pocket.
They'll go to the drugstore, they'll get charged $20 or $40 for their prescriptions. Those kinds of things employees are going to tend to know about. Oftentimes, they don't really know how much the employer is paying for their health insurance premium.
That's because you generally pay part of the cost and your employer pays the rest. And your contribution is probably lifted out of your paycheck before you even get it, so you don't miss it. But you may be missing something else. Henry Aaron is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
In the end, workers end up paying for their health insurance through lower cash wages or other fringe benefits.
But that connection isn't obvious, which may be one reason an overwhelming majority of Americans say they're satisfied with their insurance. And economists say employer-based plans may have other hidden costs, too. John Gruber teaches at MIT. Too often, Gruber says, these plans tend to insulate workers from the real cost of the health care they're consuming.
That gives no incentive for providers to treat you cost-effectively or necessarily for you to shop for the most cost-effective insurance. Part of why we have the world's highest costs and they're rising rapidly.
In a world where your health insurance isn't tied to your job, the argument goes, consumers would be free to shop around. That would force insurance companies to compete for your business, which in turn would rein in prices. That's what happens in other markets, like automobile insurance.
Don't worry, Speed. I have good news.
Tell me, Trixie.
I just saved a bunch of money on my car insurance by switching to Geico.
But some economists think there's a limit to how much difference competition would make in health insurance. The Brookings Institution's Henry Aaron says it's just the nature of health insurance plans to encourage higher spending.
The great majority of our health care spending occurs during high-cost episodes. Any system of insurance, whether it's provided through employers or by a government plan, is going to protect workers from those costs.
Still, Aaron says more information and more choice in the insurance market would help. That's why he supports the idea of insurance exchanges, government-regulated marketplaces where consumers can compare different insurance plans. Exchanges are being talked about as a possible part of the healthcare overhaul. But according to the legislation taking shape now, if your employer offers healthcare benefits, you wouldn't be eligible for the exchanges. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace Money.
Time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your money questions. And our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here to do just that. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
And first, we have David on the phone in Fargo, North Dakota. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. What's your question for us today?
Well, I tell you, my partner and I are actually legally married in Canada, but of course our marriage is not recognized here in the United States nor North Dakota.
Right.
And we had some questions about whether we should be setting up a living trust in order to protect each other. You know, do we have any worries about tax issues, even if our estates are less than $1.5 million, all that kind of thing?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Boy, Chris, complicated questions. Since they were actually married in Canada, does that make any difference?
It can make a difference in certain states.
Hmm.
So certain states, for example, like New York State, it's recognized. So it's become a really complicated area. And the main thing is you're going to get socked on taxes in case one of you died just because of the way the laws are written. But at least what you're really trying to do is arrange it so that your wishes, what you want, because you don't have the normal traditional protections that are offered to heterosexual couples, that your wishes are followed.
Right.
And that's what a trust will really do. And that's why in many states it will be recommended to have a living trust. It doesn't protect you or save you on taxes. It's that your wishes and your partner's wishes, they're followed.
Protect us from vindictive relatives.
That's a very, very big issue, and
yep,
it's very important. So this isn't one of those areas where I think for same-sex couples it's really important to work with a lawyer and a lawyer who is knowledgeable in this area.
Yeah, so that answers my question about whether we needed to go to the expense of a lawyer. So apparently we do.
Well, Chris, how much does it generally cost to set up a trust like that?
It will vary. It'll be several hundred dollars. And then I'm assuming that we're not talking a particularly complicated estate. But as your estate grows, as your lives grow together, you add more property, you have more assets, you'll be revisiting the lawyer. So, you know, the cost is going to go up. But this is one of those times where you don't want to be penny wise, pound foolish.
Right.
A couple good sources of information to go to. Two sites. I really like NOLO.com. And at NOLO.com, they have a section, lesbian and gay couples, where they keep up with changes in the law, constantly updated by lawyers.
Okay.
And then there's a pretty good website, which I only recently have been spending some time on, called QueerSense.com.
Okay.
Chris, is that a play on words? Is that QueerSense as in C-E-N-T-S?
As in C-N-T-S.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Lambda Legal Fund, everyone it says has the best information in terms of just keeping up with the legal changes in terms of how they will affect same-sex couples.
Okay. Terrific.
Okay.
So does that help you out, David?
It does. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And I'll be checking out those websites and go from there.
And we'll have links to those on our site as well. Thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you.
And next, we'll take an email from Helene in Watsonville, California. She and her husband are in their 50s, and they are trying to protect their retirement money from being, quote, taxed to death when the time comes to take distributions. She's worried that there could be policy changes on taxes and all kinds of things before they start taking that money out. So she's wondering if there's any way to shield the 401k and IRA money that they've socked away. So I guess we're asking you to predict the future.
Okay. Oh, well, no problem. No problem whatsoever. I'll be glad to do that. You know, I have a real middle-of-the-road position, Tess. I don't like this tax to your debt. You're going to save your money in your 401k, and then when you withdraw it, everything's going to be taxed away. And I hear that, and it's out there. This is the United States. Not going to happen.
Okay.
That's why I say I feel very safe in that forecast. On the other hand, when you look at our federal budget deficit, and you look at healthcare, you look at Social Security, you look at defense, a lot of the obligations that we've taken on, it's fair to say the taxes are going to go up. But I think there'll be some sort of major tax reform to do it. But we're not going to tax people to death. So What I would do is you have a 401k. So when you withdraw the money, you pay ordinary income tax. That's your federal rate. So set up a Roth IRA. Now, you put in after-tax dollars into a Roth. They're over 50, so they can put a maximum of $6,000. You know, when you withdraw the money in retirement, it's tax-free. So in a way, you're kind of diversifying your tax base. It's always kind of hard to know. Like you said, I really can't predict the future tests. Wish I could, but I really can't. So I have no idea taxes are going to be higher or taxes are going to be lower. But this way, you know, you can kind of do well in either environment.
So protect yourself.
Diversification. It's true.
Okay. If you've got questions for us, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. By FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Lots of folks are doing whatever possible to save some cash in this recession. Cutting expenses is an obvious way to do it. Pass on that expensive meal. Opt for a used car instead of one off the showroom floor. When you're on vacation, maybe forgo a comfy bed and sleep on the hotel floor. Wait, what? Yes, that is the frill-free package awaiting some guests at a San Diego resort. No bed, no toilet paper, all for $19 a night. Our intrepid Cash Peters booked a room and lived, if you can call it that, to tell about it.
You see the trouble Twitter can get you into? For a lark, John Gates, general manager of the Rancho Bernardo Inn, thought he'd try to attract more business to his lovely four-star resort near San Diego with a simple tweeted offer for a bargain room.
I said, it's $219 with breakfast. No one tweeted back. Okay, $209 without breakfast. And I kept going down, all right, no towels in the room, $189. And I got down to about $59, $39 if memory serves. And finally I said, okay, nothing in the room, no bed, you sleep on the floor. And a lot of people said, we'll do it.
It's like $5, we nail down the toilet seat.
That's not going to work.
No, but I bet they considered it. Point is, it began as a gag. Let's charge guests next to nothing, then instead of a bed, have them sleep on the floor in a tent. But let's make it sound way less horrifying by giving it a special name.
It's urban camping, camping on carpet.
Yes, bright-sounding PR person, that's exactly what it is. Camping indoors. What could be more fun than that? Well, everything, it turns out. Mary Anderson is their marketing whiz.
The $19 is no electricity, no TV, no sheets, toilet paper, toiletries. So
it's like a Dickensian orphanage, actually, is what it is now.
Not really. No, not really.
Yes, it is. But hey, in a faltering economy, you do what you can. Many of these sprawling luxury resorts and spas are operating at only 20% capacity right now, which is sad for them, but great for us. Means there are all kinds of amazing deals to be had, like the $19 a night survivor package. Lindsay Koop gave me a tour of my luxury, yet somehow not, room.
So, on a bar is empty.
So there's nothing in there?
Nothing in there. Bare pantry. Nothing. And then this is the bathroom with...
Nothing.
No lights, so it's really hard to see, but...
But I could miss the toilet in the dark.
I know, you need a flashlight.
Oh, great. Now they tell me. Even the music that's playing in the room when you arrive... has notes taken out of it. Brian Schuto is a former guest. He owns a bank, yet he's also incredibly cheap, I'm guessing, because he slept in a tent too.
For $19, I figured I'd give it a shot, and you know, if it didn't work, I was out $19. If it worked, I found a really cool place that I could refer all my friends.
And did it work? No.
No. Basically, it's the Vegas principle. Get people into your hotel at all costs, and once they're there, well, they have to eat and drink, right? And be entertained. That's how you make your money.
I spent a fair amount of money on alcohol at the pool. I spent a fair amount of money for dinner, and I spent, you know, quite a bit of money at breakfast. So, you know, the fact that I got here and didn't spend any money on the room wasn't the point.
Exactly. Anyway, after a hard day's relaxing, gourmet meals, massages, golf, it's back to your room, and then it hits you. You're sleeping in a tent. One thing to note here, if you do choose a novelty package like this, be sure to read the small print. You know, like I didn't. See what you're getting yourself into. That way you don't end up walking into a wall in the dark.
Ooh, ow, ow, ow.
Or suffocating in a hot, stifling enclosed space.
There's no window in here.
Or opening a tent flap and getting a face full of dirt and bugs. Brian Shooter.
I didn't have any problem falling asleep. It was halfway during the night at some point where my body kind of hurt.
Well, yeah, I bet it did. Luckily, if you do wimp out and decide you need to use the bathroom, say, then for $5, the guy on the front desk will sell you an emergency bag of toiletries. The ones you used to steal and take home when they were free. Honestly, it's shocking how much comfort people are willing to give up just to get a good deal. Lindsay Coop again.
No one has changed their mind. A couple people have forgot the toilet paper and they've paid for toilet paper at the front desk.
But people could survive, you think, if they had to?
Of course, that's the whole thing, the survivor package.
That's right, and I did survive. Well, you know, almost. In San Diego, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
One company started following foreclosures a year before the housing crisis hit. Did they know something we didn't?
I'd be lying to you if we were to say we saw it coming to the degree or the volume that it hit.
Hear what the leaders of RealtyTrack did see and where they think the foreclosure market is going next. Plus, couples who want a wedding on the cheap might consider a park or a friend's backyard. But apparently even the 99-cent store can be transformed by love.
And it looks, like, totally different. Like, you wouldn't expect it to be possible for them to do the things that they've done.
Taking vows for less than a buck, you're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This Labor Day week brought with it a fresh start in school for most of the nation's kids. Wall Street seemed inspired by the idea that the dog days of summer are over. But in the housing market, there is no let-up in the dreariness. This week, the folks at RealtyTrack released their foreclosure numbers for August. One in every 357 homes is in some stage of being lost to the bank. RealtyTrack's monthly report is a must-have for anyone following the housing market, but even they never imagined a day where foreclosures would be dinner table conversation. The company's main business is actually listing foreclosed properties on its website. At their headquarters in Irvine, California, call center workers field questions all day long from people who want to buy those homes.
80209 is the zip code you said? Okay, so 80209, and then you want 20 properties. So let's say the inventory only includes 10 properties.
I sat down with RealtyTrack CEO Jim Saccaccio and VP Rick Sharga. I first asked Jim how they go about counting all those foreclosures.
We have an independent army, so to speak.
So it's not governments or...
real estate agents, wow. no government agencies to provide it. Huh. This is all out of public record after a first legal notice has been filed. We go out there and do it the old-fashioned way and really collect the documents and review the documents and then input the documents into our system.
Rick?
Nobody else has the same breadth of coverage that we have in the database. And it is a tedious, almost unbelievably arcane process where almost none of the counties in the country have this information online or even electronically filed. So you're in most cases pulling paper files and recompiling it online. It's amazing.
Jim, why did you all think or see that this was going to be a need?
I can't say we had that much advanced knowledge of that or foresight into that. When I got here at the end of 2000, beginning of 2001, less than 1% of all first and second mortgages were in foreclosure. I think today it's somewhere more around 4%. My prior background was in the banking business. It was not uncommon for people to call me up and say, hey, I'd like to buy an REO, a bank-owned property. Can you get me the list? And I would say, well, that's the furthest thing from what I do. No, I can't get you the list. So the concept of having this information, I always knew in the back of my mind that people wanted that.
Then, Rick, you had here at Realty Track a pulse on the foreclosure issue, I would guess, ahead of what a lot of people knew.
We really started running a report on U.S. foreclosures back in 2004.
So that would have been actually at the height of the housing boom.
We were right in the midst of the housing boom. The reason we started the report, which comes out monthly, is so we could credentialize ourselves as a reliable and reputable provider of foreclosure information. And we've been doing this for a full year when the market shifted gears and suddenly foreclosures became kind of a household word.
When did you start getting an inkling that there might be problems coming down the pike?
January 2006 is really when we saw the higher levels of foreclosures, higher levels of properties that entered foreclosure actually going back to the banks. We did see this coming, but I'd be lying to you if we were to say we saw it coming to the degree or the volume that it hit.
There has been talk of waves of foreclosures, different kinds of foreclosures. Is that something that you have tracked through the numbers?
This has been a very unusual cycle. Normally, you could track a foreclosure cycle pretty reliably. You'd see an economic downturn, followed by job loss, followed by foreclosures. When this foreclosure wave started, unemployment was at historically low rates. Interest was at historically low rates, and the economy was growing at 4%. So what started this one was what turned out to be unsustainable home prices coupled with really bad lending practices. That led to an economic downturn, which has now led to the second wave of foreclosures, which are really unemployment-related. Unemployment numbers, if they peak end of this year, first quarter of next year, will drive foreclosure activity at least through the middle of next year, at which point there's another wave of bad loans that are option arms. They all start to reset about halfway through next year. So we're going to have back-to-back-to-back waves of residential foreclosures, really for the first time in history. And it probably won't be back down to normal numbers of both inventory and activity until probably after 2012.
Wow. I guess it just seems like this is one company. There's been so much horrible news out of this crisis, but this is one company where, boy, it was serendipitous to start tracking this stuff in 2005. Jim?
In the early days, when prices were rapidly rising, people were being boxed out of the market. Not everyone could buy a home. So they were chasing the incline in the market. Conversely, now the market is going down and people are looking for information to educate themselves as to what's available and when do I reach the bottom of a market where I should jump in and buy. So what we found is that this information has weathered good times in real estate and bad times in real estate. It has value.
Rick?
I think what's changed dramatically and maybe permanently in the real estate market is I don't think we'll have another generation of home buyers anytime soon that doesn't at least consider a foreclosure or a bank property when they're out on the market. And that simply wasn't true a few years ago.
Yeah, that is a big change. Well, Rick Sharga and Jim Sicaccio, thank you both for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
We're back with more Getting Personal, and Chris Farrell is with me once again to take on your questions. And Chris, Amy is on the phone in Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Amy.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're doing well. And you?
Good.
And how can we help you out today?
I had a question about a mortgage. I refinanced my home in April to a 20-year fixed mortgage to try to lower my interest rate.
Did you get a lower rate?
I did. I actually lowered it by about a percentage point.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So the loan I took out was originally through my credit union, and they quickly sold it to another company,
mm-hmm.
and I set up my automatic withdrawal from them,
right.
And they then, about a month later, sold it to another company.
Oh, boy.
And actually, just last week, I was told again it was sold.
Whoa!
My question is, will this ever stop? Because 20 years of this will make me crazy, I think.
Wow. Chris is selling it 3-4 times. Is that the norm?
Not Not this quickly. Three or four times over the life of a 20-year loan, sure, that can happen fairly easily. But this is rather unusual. But I have to tell you, I was looking at this calculation the other day, and I'm going to have it just slightly off. But if you have a portfolio of mortgages, and yours is included in there, and if it's sold every month, they actually make more in fee income than they do off the interest income.
Oh, wow.
From the underlying mortgages. So you can kind of see what the incentive is. I think right now, banks, credit unions, everybody is just desperate for fee income. You probably have good credit. It's a good mortgage. Everyone's going, hey, we'll buy this, and then we're going to sell it to make that fee income.
All right. So is there anything she can do about this? I can see why this would get very annoying.
I think it would get very annoying. Yeah. My guess is that it's got to slow down. You're not going to be 20 years of this, but it's part of the Wild West right now in the mortgage industry.
Really? Okay, good. Because I thought, I was being smart by refinancing, but now I feel like I don't know if this is a bad move or what.
No, you made a good move. Think about it this way. You got a much lower interest rate, and you got a headache in order to accomplish those goals.
Okay.
And it sounds like maybe the key here is wait on setting up that automatic withdrawal maybe for a couple of months until you get with the same bank for at least a little while.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, and just write the check.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
And Chris, next we have an email from Dan in your neck of the woods, Eagan, Minnesota. He says his family is on the way to outgrowing their house. They've got a couple of young kids sharing a bedroom. He's been paying a few extra $100 on his mortgage every month. It's a fixed 30-year. But he wants to move in a few years, so he's wondering if there's any point to paying down the mortgage more than he has to. Or should the family be saving that money somewhere else?
Any suggestion of what sort of time frame we're talking about?
It looks like about 7 years.
Okay. You know what I would do, Tess, is not accelerate my mortgage payments right now. 7 years, who knows what's going to happen, what the market's going to be. Maybe you're going to move in 4 years. Maybe you're going to decide to remodel rather than move.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, if they like their neighborhood, they like the schools, they like the environment, they might think, okay, maybe we can do a little bit of an addition here, keep our costs down. So at this point in time, I'd probably be putting it into a savings account. And the reason is, let's have maximum flexibility. Then you can put the money back into the mortgage and, really, pay off a big chunk of it. You might tap into that to remodel if you decide not to move. And then if you do decide to move, then you have some additional savings in order to help you get the place you really want.
All right. Sounds good. So, Dan, hold off a little bit on paying down that mortgage, I think is what we're saying here, until you maybe get a little further into that 7 years.
Yeah.
And that's all the time we have for Getting Personal on this week's show. You can find more answers to your questions on our website at Chris's blog. It's marketplace.org. And you'll also find the Getting Personal link there to write us an email with your question. Or give us an old-fashioned phone call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
What's the last thing you want your wife to call your anniversary present? Cheap, right? But that's exactly what my spouse and I were going for. The stingiest present ever.
Hodding Carter has been blogging about his new frugal existence for gourmet.com. Think family of six, $550 a month to live on. That's after the mortgage payment. Here's his latest installment for us.
A while back, Lisa noticed six identical chairs for sale on the side of the road. In our house, none of the furniture matches. And the pieces that once did were ruined by our four children and countless pets long ago. And Lisa has a chair fetish. She wanted those peeling quarter-sawn chairs. Big time. The seller was asking $20 a piece. I didn't call that day, that week, or even the next, employing one of my many newfound frugal skills, patience. When the owner finally gave up and brought the chairs inside, I pounced, talked her down to $10 a chair, and drove home grinning with victory. The day of our anniversary, I taped a used ribbon to one of the chairs and prepared to watch her crumble in defeat. She smiled, said how she loved them, and even nodded her head approvingly when I bragged about the price. When it was her turn, she handed over a sealed envelope. Ah, a certificate for some massages, I sighed to myself. She's way outspent me, and I get massages to boot. I've won. I definitely won. I stopped gloating the second I ripped it open. Oh, no, I groaned. I lost. I definitely lost. What did the card say? Vacation getaway. Accommodations for two for 3 days and two nights, plus $50 in dinner rewards. It was, without a doubt, the most selfless, perfect present I'd ever received. Not only had she performed the unthinkable, conversed with a telemarketer for nearly an hour over the phone, she'd also agreed to endure a 5-hour sales pitch. The vacation was hers as long as she made it to the end. No purchase necessary. Of course she did, dodging all advances from the flirtatious, elderly British salesman, whose many charms included bad breath, a mismatched toupee, and an aura of defeat that almost, but not quite, guilted her into buying a timeshare we could never afford. Humbled, I bowed before her and declared she was not only my true love, but once and for all, the queen of frugality.
W. Hodding Carter is writing about his family's experience with extreme frugality for Gourmet.com. So we've just heard about anniversaries on the cheap and earlier staying in a hotel on the ridiculous cheap. Now for the icing on the cheap cake. Weddings in this country cost an average of more than $20,000. But this week, here in Los Angeles, nine couples paid $19,999, less than that. The 99-cent store held a promotion on Wednesday, 9909, for nine couples to pay just 99 cents to get married in its store aisles. After all, you cannot put a price on love. Willis Hall Jr. and Emily Wiley were one of the happy couples. He's a corporal in the Marines. She works in the pharmaceutical industry. We talked with them right after they took their vows and cut the cake. And I asked Willis what his wedding was like.
Well, the image that everyone has, I mean, from something like this, it's totally different because what they do is they actually use everything from within the 99-cent store and they make the decorations and everything. And it looks like totally different. Like you wouldn't expect it to be possible for them to do the things that they've done.
Willis, do you take Emily to be your wife, to love, honor, comfort, and cherish her from this day forth?
Absolutely.
All right, is Emily there with you?
Yes, she is. Hold on.
Hi.
Hi, Emily. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Was this the wedding of your dreams?
I didn't have one. I had a man of my dreams, and I found him, and I married him.
So what did you think of it? Describe it for us.
We are very impressed. We are very happy. Everything's beautiful here, and it totally doesn't feel like you're in a 99-cent store until you have the backdrop of chicken noodle soup behind you and your picture's taken.
I, Emily Wiley.
I, Emily Wiley.
Take you, Willis Hall Jr.
Take you, Willis Hall Jr.
To be my husband.
To be my husband.
To have and to hold.
To have and to hold.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
For richer or for poorer.
For richer and for richer.
Willis, I understand that you are heading to Afghanistan.
That's correct.
So what were your plans if this particular opportunity hadn't worked out for you?
Well, we had already planned on, as soon as I got back from Afghanistan, to actually have a traditional wedding, you know, save up some money and do it from there. But this opportunity just happened to present itself, so we acted upon it.
Were you nervous at all about doing it this way?
I was a bit skeptical at first, you know, but there's a lot of things that make me nervous, and this is not one of them.
You know, I think the average cost for a wedding is something like $20,000, maybe more.
Oh, easily.
Now, you have done it for less than a buck.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. You know, I mean, who would pass something up like that? Everyone has something unique about their wedding, you know. Oh, mine was the longest, or this happened at that. You know, I can say, well, yeah, I had mine for 99 cents in a 99-cent store.
And I guess you're never going to forget the anniversary date either. It's pretty easy for you.
Oh, if I forget that, I need to be shot.
Willis and Emily, now that you have heard the words about love and marriage, it is with great joy and happiness that I now pronounce you husband and wife. You may kiss your bride.
Newlyweds Willis and Emily Hall speaking with us last Wednesday from the 99 Cent Store on Sunset Boulevard in, where else, Hollywood. Want to see what a 99 Cent wedding looks like? Check out the photos on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, tax credits and lower prices made lots of folks eager to buy a home. But should they?
It sounds obvious, but you want to buy a home if you're going to live in it.
How you'll know if you'll be a successful first-time home buyer. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Special thanks this week to Eve Abrams, Raphael Cohen, Corb O'Connor, Tim Wirth, and Mitchell Hartman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. American Public Media.